This is Japan Baseball Weekly. News, interviews, analysis, and your questions, all about NPB. And now your hosts, Johnny Gibson and Jim Allen.
Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast. It's for the week of August 29th already, last show for August. I'm your host this week, filling in for John Gibson, and joining me this time from Toronto is the creator of Baseball Japones, the premier Spanish language website devoted to Japanese baseball, our friend and colleague Claudio Rodriguez. So how's it going, Claudio?
It's going great. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, man, we always love having you on the show. You and all the guys, we wish we could do it more often. It's just the logistics, but we really appreciate you standing in for John, who's taking a well-deserved vacation with his family. We've got a packed show this week, part one of my interview with former Nippon Ham Fighters manager Trey Hillman. We'll talk about the latest no-hitter, the pennant races, rocking with Roki Sasaki, and more. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases!
Okay, on Monday, this past Monday, I had a fairly long chat with the former Fighters and Kansas City Royals and SK Wyvern's manager, Trey Hillman. He said he was he's managed in four countries. I'm trying to guess the other one, but I'll just leave that to people who want to look up on Baseball Reference. And we talked about a wide range of subjects. So anyway, Trey is now the development staff training coach for the Los Angeles Angels.
Which nice.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of interesting because my image of the Angels under their hopefully soon to be former owner, Artie Moreno, has been that the minor leagues have not been a big priority for them. That, you know, let's just have it because we have to have it and pay them as little as we can possibly do and, you know, put them through as much misery as we possibly can to toughen them up or something. I don't know the deal, but anyway, so the idea of that Trey's there applying science and common sense to their minor league system seems kind of a contradiction, but happy that he's there helping because, you know, he's such a great guy. So let's hear what Trey had to say. Our guest this week on the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast is former Nippon Ham Fighters manager and kind of man around world baseball, Trey Hillman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Jim. It's great to hear your voice.
You're taking a year. You were going to take a year off, but you don't take anything off, do you?
No. It's always been my nature to stay busy and to work, and you know, anytime any of my family or friends or anybody that knows me well hears that I'm planning on slowing down, they kind of laugh at that.
So. I'll bet. I didn't think you were slowing down, but from the reasons you gave me, I have to ask, how's your dad?
Oh, my dad's doing great, Jim. Thanks for asking. He's doing great. He will be 88 years old in October. You know, other than the same thing that a lot of elderly people deal with eyesight and hearing loss, he's doing great.
Oh, wonderful.
But he still plays his guitar. We do FaceTime concerts with one another. So,
wow.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm very envious of that. I know I shouldn't be envious of anybody, but that's one of the things I am. Okay, I want to start actually kind of on, since we're talking about life stuff, I wanted to ask you some, I guess, the heavy question is, if you had your baseball life to live over again, what would you do differently this time? And I guess what I mean is, you know, what important lesson did it take in your mind far too long to learn?
Oh, I think probably, Jim, first, and I've got two things for you on that front.
Okay.
The first thing would have been to, I felt like I asked a lot of questions, but even when I was younger and starting out managing, I wish that I had been less fearful of people thinking that I didn't know the answer because I was made a manager at such a young age.
Okay.
In the, in the, in the, in the development system with the Yankees. You know, I wish I'd asked more questions. I can remember being a little bit hesitant early on to ask questions because I felt the pressure that I had to live up to the confidence that they showed in me and making me a manager at such a young age of 27. And then the second thing would probably be to have been a little bit more patient. Not a lot, but a little when I got the Kansas City job after leaving, after leaving Japan, because I knew that was going to be a process, a building process, and with basically an inadequate roster as far as being competitive at a playoff level. I just wasn't smart enough and patient enough to realize that at the years of 2008, 2009, and 2010. So those are the two primary things.
Okay. Now, another thing I want to get into and talking about patience and not knowing it all, I get a lot of questions about Shohei Ohtani, and I know you had zero to do with Shohei Ohtani, or next to zero with him, says a lot about the organization. What does it tell you about that team that they were able to, A, come up with this idea to let this guy do what he could do and have his back all that time?
Well, you know, I see the parallel very clearly just because of what I experienced with the fighters. And for me, I think it's a pretty good argument with anybody. And obviously, I'm going to be prejudicial for the fighters. I still consider them family. And they're kind of trendsetters, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was an island that had never had its own team.
Mm-hmm.
They go out and they hire an American manager that didn't have any international experience and no major league time. Then when we moved to the Big Island after my first year there and finishing up in Tokyo, they were not afraid. So I would say it's very relative with what they did with Ohtani. I mean, they just showed a tremendous lack of fear for being trendsetters and, you know, making wise decisions on something that they thought had an opportunity to be a great commodity and a two-way player. And obviously they were right. So, I mean, he was a super freak in Japan, and he comes to the United States, and he's still super freaky, you know. And I think it's a tremendous credit to them, just being fearless.
That maybe it's an irony, you know, that in Japan they speak about baseball as being this world of challenges. You know, they use the word shobu a lot, confrontation. But in fact, so often, what we have is, I don't want to be negative because it's human nature to avoid accountability, I think. And one of the pillars of your tenure there was insisting on accountability, but that wasn't easy. I mean, that because Japan, you know, nobody likes accountability is never painless, but I don't think any culture in the world values keeping painful things out of sight more than Japan does.
I would agree with that, Jimmy. At least the places I've been.
How hard was that process? Because we've talked about the end results of it, but how hard was that process? It must not have been easy.
Well, I wouldn't say that it was easy, but I wouldn't say that it was extremely difficult other than just the simple things that go along with it being difficult to put in a new system and to be blessed with having the autonomy to the degree that I did in being able to put in a new system. And then the trust, really. So for me, really, it goes back to the people that had the confidence to hire me in the first place, and Takojima and Toshi Shimada and Okoso-san, you know, the ownership group. And I know that it's since I've left, I still keep up with it. I know that it's not exactly structured the same way that it was. As it wouldn't be with any company, you know, and over the number of years that I've been gone from Japan. But Really, Jimmy, for me, it goes back to, without trying to sound cliche-ish, it goes back to being able to develop relationships with good people and that trust, and that's a two-way street, you know. So although I had autonomy on some things, I had to emphasize on the front end that I would still continue to use the hierarchy and correspond with them to try to come up with what we always said. Let's make sure we're making East and West come together somewhere, and it doesn't necessarily have to be in the middle, but it's got to be what's best for the organization and to win baseball games, what's best for the players.
Right.
And you've heard the story about Mac Kaneko and telling me some things about the culture that were very instrumental for me getting a better feel, which led to me, I thought I was, you know, I had read enough, you know, from my research over the internet and reading Robert Whiting's books and research in Japanese history all the way back to the Edo period and reading about the samurai, and then, you know, getting educated by my de facto team captain, Matt Kaneko. That led me to read Bushido.
Okay.
And it, you know, but really, to answer your question directly, it goes back to the people. I worked with just tremendous people, and we weren't afraid to spend a lot of badly needed time to try to come up with the best equation to do something special. Mm. And I think we did that. So,
Time's a great topic, because I remember when your first opening day at Tokyo Dome, you had the players. Remember, Hichori Morimoto was out with a number of other players greeting the fans as they came into Tokyo Dome. And, you know, I talked about that with a number of different people in different organizations. And they said, the players are always pushing against that, because they're under this belief that if they're not spending every waking minute swinging a bat or doing shadow pitching, that they're falling behind, you know, that they're doing something, you know, they're cheating. And that's
right.
It's a hard obstacle to get over.
Yeah, it is a hard obstacle, but that, you know, in trying to provide an atmosphere that allowed the players a little bit more freedom, as long as there was good timing and presentation in their culture with being approachable by the manager, but also, more importantly, them to the manager.
Mm.
They gave me what I think was a benefit, and they kind of had a mulligan culturally. You know, this wasn't a Japanese renowned manager. This was some guy that nobody had heard of from the United States.
Right.
And I was okay with that. And, you know, I just wanted to try to get that part of it right. So it kind of gave them a mulligan, I think, to maybe be a little bit more comfortable with doing something like a Kaneko did. Mm-hmm. And then when we got Tsuyoshi Shinjo, and he came in with his flamboyant behavior and his great pleasing of everything that he did and continues to do now that he's the new manager. I mean, there are probably a lot of traditional Japanese that would disagree that in the way that I look at it, but I've always looked at it this way. We're a sport, yes, but we're also an entertainment industry, and it needs to be entertaining, and it needs to serve what is best for the entertainment and that relationship between the players and the fans, at least to some degree. Mm-hmm. And I thought our players did a wonderful job of that during my 5 years over there.
Yeah, certainly that's a tension in Japan, between the old guys. And I say the old guys, the former players who will tell you, well, we didn't do this when I was a kid. About, you know, you have to spend every minute doing it, and entertainment is somebody else's problem. So, so there's always...
Well, that helped me with my teaching there too, Jim.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I continued to emphasize the quality over quantity.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in hopes that we could meet somewhere in between, you know, if that meant 80% Japanese, 20%, you know, Western American, I was okay with that. Just as long as they were continuing to see that there might be a different way to skin that cat, so to speak.
The quality over quantity is something that I kind of wanted to think about in terms of Shohei Ohtani, because I think one of the fundamental objections to him doing both in Japan was that none of the guys who became great by splitting their time between two quite different, you know, they didn't say, sorry, coach, I got to go study Latin, you know, at 3 p.m, because that's important to me too. And I think it's kind of an affront to the guys who say, if you're going to be a great hitter, you got to spend, you know, 12 hours a day working on your hitting. You can't be dallying with pitching.
Right. And I, you know, I'm sure that there were more people in the decision-making process of whatever the recipe was going to be for Shohei. Mm. But from what I do know, and I know the man and I know the character, and I know he did a wonderful job as the manager of the Fighters in Okudayama-san, I think that he handled it exceptionally well.
Mm.
A lot of the reason is because I think he's very well spoken. I think he's got a very pleasant demeanor.
Mm.
And I think most probably, even though I wasn't there to witness it, the things that I've heard and just knowing his character, I think that he probably handled the interviews and the hundreds of questions and maybe even questions that might have been slanted in a cultural way that was like, hey, you guys shouldn't be doing this. And I think his personality was something that was key, and probably, I don't know this factually, but probably putting Shohei at ease as he ventured out into this new frontier of being a two-way player, as you've already stated, in a culture that's not too easy to do that in.
I think what's most unique about him is not that he's doing both, but that he's so confident in his reason for doing both.
You know, sure.
He's so,
he does it because he knows he can.
Sure. Well, that's another thing too. That's part of it, that a lot of people don't have that. So,
okay. So, thank you so much, Trey, for that first part. The second part will be next week when John comes back. And any comments, Claudio?
Well, it's, first of all, of course, just listening to him, it's awesome. He's, as you mentioned, Trey's a great guy, and he has tons of interesting stories to share. I confirm his, how would you say that? He's, the way he mentions the how well the Nippon Ham Fighters organization works, how daring they are in trying new things, like, you know, in the case of Shohei Ohtani, the way they went ahead to develop him. I would add to that, and I don't think people mention that enough with Nippon Ham, they're very, very good during the drafts. Not only they have luck, you know, they got Yuki Saito, they got Sugano in his time, and then Sugano sat down a year because he didn't want to sign with them, and then went on the next draft to sign with Yomiuri. They always seem to get the most coveted player of the draft, you know, almost every year. And I don't think people applaud that enough. Like, and of course, they took the bet with Ohtani, even though Ohtani had said, don't choose me because I'm not going to sign with him. In the last minute, they went in and boom, they got him. And they convinced him to stay in Japan and start his career there. So, I mean, that's another part of the, again, I don't think people mention that enough, but you have to recognize that. They have luck, and they are daring. They're definitely go for it. They're smart in that sense, and they definitely have some success in the draft as well. So I thought it was great. I agree with his description of Hideki Kuriyama as a manager, and you know how nice guys, how well-spoken, how calm. I thought it was great for him to mention as well. And pretty nice to hear as well, you know, his relationship with his dad, the fact that they both play guitar in front of each other, you know, through a video or whatever. That's awesome. I mean, it's all you can hope for, to stay connected with your dad, you know, even though he's so old, 88, I believe he mentioned at the time. So that's great. And I mean, what else can you say?
Yeah, I'm very envious of that. Get into much personal details, but it's something I never really had. So I'm glad Trey's, you know, making that as big a thing in his life as he can. He's always been about family. He left the fighters so that his kids, he could be home for his kids in America and wouldn't be in Japan when they were going, you know, so he could be a bigger influence on what he considered very informative years for them. And he left SK Wyvern because his parents were not well. And he told me in November that I asked about his dad, because he said, I want to spend more time with my dad while he's still, you know, while we're still able to enjoy each other's company so much. And so I envisioned him. And when I talked to him, he was out clearing brush on his ranch. And, I think Liberty Hill, Texas. And he told me, you know, I envisioned him being it with the ranch and traveling a little bit. So when I called him last month, he said, I'm taking business trips. I'm thinking, what? And then that accounts for the, you know, whenever I tell people I'm slowing down, they kind of, yeah. Because it doesn't really happen. He doesn't have an off button.
Yeah, exactly.
He's a little bit obsessive compulsive about that. I love Trey, but that's probably the best description for him. He doesn't stop if there's something that needs to be doing that he can do right now. I've heard a few stories about that, and I won't go on about it. But yeah, I thought that was good. And of course, the fighters, they are willing to do things that are new and different from Japan. They're probably, as I've said, they're the most MLB-like franchise in Japan. And I mean that in not a good way at all. they certainly, I'll just say it. They extorted the city of Nago in Okinawa to build them a better spring training facility. And they extorted the city of Kita Hiroshima to essentially give them all that land so they can make money without playing baseball. So, you know, they're wolves, really. And although they're very fan friendly wolves, you know, I guess this year we can say they're wolves in fox clothing. So,
yep.
But, you know, it's their business, you know, let them go with it. So, yeah, I thought that was also applicable to I love the comments about Tsuyoshi Shinjo, because one of the things when Trey was manager and that I remember was with Shinjo in center field and Atsunori Inaba in right field, whenever the fighters had a pitching change, you remember this? When Trey was manager, the fighters outfielders would all gather in center field, put their gloves on their heads and take a knee and sit there and chat. And it was like,
oh,
and people were going, isn't that kind of like disrespectful or something? Said, no, they want to do it. It's their thing, you know?
Exactly.
And I just love that. And the fighters took to it. So, you know, that was really Trey. And I think the fighters doing fighters stuff is kind of the brand. So good for them. I have to say this is a two seam sinker transition to talk about fighters, because that was the pitch on Saturday. We're recording Sunday morning in Japan and Saturday night in Toronto. On Saturday afternoon in Japan, Cody Ponce threw the fifth no-hitter of the season. in Japanese professional baseball and making really good use. I mean, his two-seamer is not, it's really, I don't know, it's not extravagant. It's not like one of these MLB two-seamers, you know, that seems to run about 3 or 4 inches and drop about an extra 3 inches. It looks like a splitter or something. It's just very subtle. It's like a, but it kept the Hawks hitters off the barrels of the bats, except for a couple of ball, except really for one ball. And just a remarkable job. So have you seen anything from that game?
Well, I watched the highlights and stuff. Okay. I didn't have the chance to watch it live, but I don't know. I mean, I keep saying that there's something going on in the Pacific League, and a lot of people mention, oh, there's the ball is dead, right, and whatever. But like, if it was only the ball, it would be affecting both leagues equally. But that's not the case. It's the Pacific League that the numbers are down. There's more offensive, the better offensive numbers in the Central League, and it's not a huge difference, but there are better offensive numbers individually and for the teams in the Central League. So something is going on, and I don't know what it is in the Pacific League that hitters are not doing well at all this year, with the exception of Otaka Yamakawa. And pitchers, of course, there are very good pitchers in the Pacific League, but I don't know if it's just a thing that the pitchers are so good. I don't know if it's just the ball. I don't know if it's just the hitters are really having a bad year. I don't know what it is. It's just the production, the offensive numbers in the Pacific League this year are horrible. I don't know what's going on there.
Well, right. We've had, of course, of the four no-hitters, five no-hitters. Okay, we've had one at Okinawa Cellular Field, which I don't know how that park plays. We had one in Cebu, which was a Yoshinobu Yamamoto's. That's one of the better hitters parks. But then we had the other three were in Chiba, which can be pretty tough on hitters. It's not a good hitter's park. And then, of course, the other one was in Sapporo Dome, which is a terrible hitter's park. Yeah. So those are the things, I think, that go into it. But it is weird. Of course, I'll tell you one thing. If you just look at so this is the fifth no-hitter ties the season maximum in Japan, 1940. Yeah. In 1940, the batting average of the Japan Baseball League was, hold on a second here, where did I put it? Oh, here it is, 208. Yeah. So, and there was essentially one no-hitter for every 100 games played. So they played, about 469 games, and there was five no hitters. So it was a little more than one per 100 games. This year we're about a third of that.
Yeah.
But of course the batting averages are a bit higher. And if you do a really rough estimation, and of course no hitters are more likely than, you know, the chance of getting 27 outs from 27 at bats in a based on the league average, because not everybody hits league average and not every pitcher is league average. So it's actually quite a bit, it's a little bit higher than that, but the difference between a 240 league batting average and a 209 batting average or whatever is makes a no-hitter about half as likely.
Yeah.
And that's about where we are in the Pacific League. And the difference between the 240 batting average and a 249 league batting average makes the no hitters about four times less likely, which is, you know, just that little difference makes a big deal. So it is a surprise, but of course, John likes to remind us that, you know, he likes to count the Roki Sasaki eight perfect innings is a no hitter. You know, it was a it was a pre no hitter, but then I, you know, you do that, then you have to start counting all of
yeah, exactly,
Fumiya Nishiguchi's games. So, okay. Yeah. So that was something, and it was really great. And I loved what Cody Ponce said about his mom after the game. You know,
I missed that. What did he say?
Well, he said basically a couple of things. And he wrote about how, you know, they ask, you know, they always ask questions like, when did you start thinking about the no hitter? And his answer was, when don't you start thinking about a no hitter? And what was going through your mind before the start of the ninth inning? He said, I felt like I was about to throw up. But he remembered his mom and dad telling him, you know, kind of give a little inspirational language they had for him. And then when it was all over, they said, what went through your mind when you got the final out? He says, I thought, you know, my thought went to my mom and how she's been with me all the time, because his mom had died of brain cancer in 2017. Oh. Two and a half years before he made his MLB debut.
Oh, okay.
So it was really emotional. And so, I enjoyed, it was just really good. The other thing, the last thing I'll mention is something I noticed, you know, when you see all the no hitters, you'll come out with the weird stories. And one story on Yahoo News, Sankei Sports Story said, the headline was, no-hit pitcher Cody Ponce is good at cooking and can make steak and avocado toast. So there is your window into Japanese sports journalism for today. Okay. All right. Well, let's make a four-seam transition. And I just wanted to ask, as long as we've got Claudio as a captive guest this week, I just want to ask you about your any comments or surprises about this season so far.
Well, it's been very interesting, and that's something I appreciate. I remember, you know, if we were to briefly go back to 2019, it was pretty clear what was going to happen. You knew the Yomiuri was going to win the Central League, SoftBank was going to win the Pacific League, and they were going to meet in the Japan Series. Like, that was clear from the beginning of the season. There was no real drama or emotion to it. You knew that was going to happen.
And we knew who was going to win the Japan Series.
Exactly. We knew it was going to be by a sweep. Like, you know, everything was known beforehand. But now, like, this season started with really the doors completely open. Anything could have happened. I didn't pick the Swallows to win again, because they have had a really bad history of keeping up their good work from one season to another. Every time they have a good season and they completely fail the season, the following season, they can repeat that success. But obviously this year they did it, and they're doing it very well. So putting the Swallows aside, at one moment, you know, after the Interleague, they were like, if they had played the Japan Series at that time, they would have swept any Pacific League team. Like, they were, you know, incredible at that period. They, you know, they went through a bad stretch, but I think they're getting better now again. But putting the Swallows aside, the rest of the playoff spots have been very, very close. There are like four teams in the Central League fighting for those last two spots for the playoffs. And in the Pacific League, you have these four teams. They are separated by what, three games, two and a half games right
now? Two and a half games.
And either one of them could win. Like, it's a very close, you know, race there. So it's very interesting. It's refreshing to have those options after some years in which you knew who was going to win all the time. So that's been great. We have the mystery with the lack of offensive in the Pacific League, but, you know, we have great stories. We have Rocky Sasaki, we have Munetaka Murakami with a chance of doing a million things, winning the Triple Crown, getting to 60 homers, or at least getting to 55, or getting to 50, which probably he's going to get there. Each one of those steps is going to be history for him. They have different things going on, so that's great. It's been very entertaining so far, and nice. I'm just looking forward to see what September is going to bring and how we get to the playoffs. But it's been pretty good.
It's going to be pretty wild. I guess the one that fooled me. I was looking today that if we took a stick of dynamite to DNA and blew them into last place, it's funny because I rarely remember my picks on our prediction show, but I remember my Central League picks really well this year. I put a lot of effort into them, and if we dynamited DNA, then they would be perfect. Because I had the current teams that are 3 through 6, I had finishing 2nd through 5th.
Oh, there you go. Well, you know what? I actually picked DNA to win the Central League this year. And John made fun of me saying, hey, were you playing Jatsi when you selected those picks? Because he was laughing at me when I did that.
Hey, that's John's job.
Exactly. But I didn't say anything so far because I didn't know if they're going to win it. But if they, for whatever reason, they end up winning, I'm going to say it was pure luck because I had no idea that was going to happen. I just picked them because I just looked at all the teams and say, okay, who has the least or who's less likely to mess things up? And I thought, okay, you know what? Maybe DNA is sort of consistent compared to the other teams. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is a team that's not going to mess things up this year. And because of that, could win. But I had no clue that they could have this great run they're having right now. And if they ended up winning, it's going to be absolute pure luck. No merit whatsoever on my pick because I didn't know they were actually going to be that close.
Now, we all, I think 5 of us picked the Lotte Marines.
Yeah,
and I tried to do a take back because after I did my PL show, after when I got to the CL show, I had a bunch of data I didn't have, or some other excuse, whatever. I'll give John another excuse next time.
# high heat.
But when I redid it the way I did the Central League, I had the Marines coming 5th.
Oh, there you go.
So, you know, it was off the cuff. You know, I liked the young talent without sort of realizing how old the team was.
Yeah.
That was the thing that got me. They were actually quite an old team last year. And old offenses don't tend to do well the next year. So that was a huge difference for me. But anyway, that one's worked. Any other big surprises in the Pacific League?
Well, look, talking about surprises, I have to mention, because it is a surprise, Leonis Martin, what happened to him this year? Like, this guy was at least the best Latin hitter for the past 2 seasons. And this year, the guy's like, I don't recognize him anymore. What's going on with him? How come he's hitting like 154 or something at this time? Doesn't even have 10 homers. He's barely playing. What's going on? I don't know. Like, how can you have that drop after two and a half successful years in Japan? But I guess it happens. I'm not.
Clueless. He had the big year last year. I mean, of course, he had a splashy debut, and a splashy debut on defense, particularly. He made a huge impact, and then of course he came in and he made a huge. You know, he said he worked on his. You know, he told John that he worked on getting more, barreling the bat more.
Yeah.
And he worked on his metrics and his swing, and that has not worked this year. How come it hasn't worked this year? I have no idea. It'd be interesting to talk with him. Brandon Laird has also looked like Brandon Laird. You know, he looks like an older version of Brandon Laird this year. So it's not a huge drop. But,
well, I have to give a shout out to one of our, let's say, newest members of the NPB covering bloggers and journalists. This account in Twitter, Yaku Cosmopolitan, has been sharing very interesting numbers. One of them was he was listing the best foreign player by WAR for each mm-hmm. team. And right. in the Lotto Marines, it was Agni Romero, the Dominican pitcher. And he's having a decent season. But if that's your best foreigner, when you have Leonis Martin, when you have Brandon Laird, when you have Aleini Echavarria, when you have, who else is in this team? Roberto Osuna, you have Tyron Guerrero, whatever. You have, you know, you have some bigger names there, but it turns out
he's probably the biggest guy.
Yeah. And then I don't know, like, what's going on with a team? How come these guys are not hitting this year? Okay. I have no clue.
Okay.
Anyways.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I guess that is all of our surprise. What happened to Lotte? And
We know what happened. We completely messed things up for them. Just by us selecting them to win, we already, you know.
Well, that's the John jinx. He tries not to pick any team he likes to win because he's afraid that that'll put the whammy on him.
Exactly. So, well, anyways, we'll take responsibility for a lot.
Yeah, we should. It's our fault.
Exactly.
So probably if I need to bow my head next time I see Tadahito Iguchi, when, you know, maybe in 4 years when NPB relaxes its COVID restrictions.
Yes.
I do run playoff projections now and then. And
all right.
They're basically based on it's a 50-50, a 500 record and what the team has done so far.
Okay.
And right now I have the Swallows, surprises. I have the Swallows beating the Bay Stars by 8.5 games. And I have a large separation between the Tigers and the bottom three in the Central League. I just think they got so much more talent. And the other thing is the Tigers are going to go home to start playing at Koshien again pretty soon.
Yeah.
And where they haven't been for a month. And that's going to make a difference. So Pacific League, I've got Rock 10 missing the playoffs by a half game with the top three teams. First time I've done a projection now with SoftBank winning in a while. They've been finishing second, but I've got them finishing a game and a half ahead of the Lions as we speak. So anyway, so that's where we are with the pennant races. Okay, let's jump now to Rockin' with Roki, our little weekly segment on Japan's Reiwa rock star Roki Sasaki. Now, he had a pretty good game in his, his fourth straight start against the Rock 10 Eagles. He threw 7 shutout innings, struck out 8, walked 2, allowed 3 hits, all singles, as he managed the Rock 10 Eagles. And I watched most of that game. And what struck me is, and I think, I don't remember whether it was Baseball Cosmopolitan or Gaijin Baseball who wrote that he has stopped throwing his slider, but I think the team has told him, don't worry about the slider right now and just throw it until you throw a strike. Once you throw a strike, your quota is good. Cause he threw 3, he threw 1 in the beginning, one sort of in the middle innings. And then he threw a 3rd and that one went for a strike. And then he didn't throw it again the rest of the game. But, at the beginning of the season, he was basically fastball splitter.
Yep.
And he'd missed the splitter right in the middle of the zone and nobody could touch it because it was so good. And the fastball was really rising. He's had more trouble. I didn't really have a look for the first time in forever because the Bay Stars Swallows game was going on at the same time.
Yeah.
I didn't have a good look at his pitches. I didn't really notice that about his fastball, which had been a kind of a problem for a while, but he pretty much was fastball splitter again. And it worked like magic. So that was good to see. And next week it will be the Oryx Buffaloes because they'll be ready for him, you know, because they've seen him at his best.
Yeah.
And so that'll be fun. But he had trouble with the Eagles. I think his ERA against the Eagles this year going into that game was like 4.9 or something.
So, yeah.
Okay. So
hey, well, before we leave the Rocky Sasaki segment,
please.
I wanna congratulate you on your on coining the phrase Rocky Sasaki Eve, which has been
Rocky
hilarious. Yeah, Rocky Eve has been hilarious all season long. Every time you put it on Twitter, hey, it's Rocky Eve, whatever, because it has been like that. People have been following him all year long, and you know. There's a lot of attention on each one of his starts. So, hey, you know, it's fun. That's what makes the MPV fun.
Oh, I appreciate that. I mean, last year it was really Masahiro Tanaka was the guy. And
yes.
he's trying to make it, you know, he's trying to make some waves again. Tanaka looks like he's going to be that guy. Like every 3 weeks, he looks like, oh man, he's back. And then he gets, you know, his control is off or something's off and his slider's not as good and he gets thumped around a little bit. But
he may be trying to get a spot on the WBC team. He's like, I have to finish strong so they can call me and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, I still have bad memories of the 2013 WBC when Tanaka went in as the ace of Japan and he pitched so badly. And I was like, so upset with him. So I don't know what's going to happen this time, whether they're going to call him or not, but we'll see.
Well, he didn't do nothing in the Olympics last year, so that will be interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So moving along, I want to make a brief transition here. I don't know, maybe it's a change up, and I talk about the MVPs. Do you have any thoughts about this year's MVPs? And anybody... Is there anybody who should win besides Hotoke Yamakawa and Munetaka Murakami?
Well, you know, the MPB has always been the okay. Who's the most deserving player on the winning team, on the champion team, the league champion team? So I think Yamakawa said, you know what, just to be on the safe side, let me win the triple crown. Let me establish. In the Central League, Munetaka Murakami, because we had this debate recently, if the Bay Stars end up winning, what's going to happen with the MVP? Because everybody knows Murakami has the best numbers, but and he deserves the win. But if the Swallows don't win the Central League pennant, then are they really going to select Murakami, yes or no? And then I think Murakami decided himself just to be on the safe side. Let me win the triple count, just in case, you know, my team doesn't make it there. let me hit more than 50 homers, hopefully more than 55 and preferably more than 60. Just so they have no excuse not to give me the award. So hopefully it should be Murakami because, you know, he deserves it in the Central League. Pacific League, I guess it will depend on who wins. I agree with you. It should be Yamakawa is far out the best hitter in the league right now. Could be Yamamoto too. You never know. He has had a good season. Mm. And in terms of war, he's up there. I don't know. We'll see who wins and who they choose at the end. But
right.
Well, I don't know.
Well, they do have this. They do have a penchant for picking the guy who has historic numbers because they feel like the reporters feel like he's the guy who obviously had the best season, and because he had historic numbers, we're allowed to vote for him. We're not allowed to vote for people who are just the best. But if they have something, they need to get numbers that will make their vote seem acceptable to the herd. So I was just thinking, would a triple crown do it? Well, in 1986, Randy Bass won his second straight triple crown with the Hanshin Tigers, but they finished third, I think. And the MVP went to Manabu Kita Beppu of the Hiroshima Carp, of course, the Central League champion Hiroshima Carp.
Yeah.
So maybe not.
Yeah, well, we have plenty of examples like that. I mean, Rami-chan had a monster season in 2010, but Yomiuri finished third and you know, and not only that, but Craig Brazella hit 47 homers that year. Tigers came in second, and he got like one vote or something. It was insane. Like, how can you give only one vote to this guy? This guy deserved more than that. So, yeah, you know, it's, you never know what's going to happen. Hopefully, whatever happens, that the award will still go to Murakami, and then Pacific League, we'll see. I don't know who's going to win it.
We'll see. I don't think either of us can guess. I can only guess about my vote, and that's probably as questionable as we're going to get. Okay. Just some notes before we wrap up today. We had this past week, Yasuaki Yamasaki of the DeNA BayStars became, he is probably for about 6 weeks, he will hold on to his title as the youngest pitcher in Japanese pro baseball to reach 200 saves.
Yep.
Because Yuki Matsui is, I think, 8 behind him and is almost three years younger.
Yeah.
So that's sort.
Hey, but at least he can say he got the record for, you know, a few weeks. So
yeah, exactly.
That's something.
And it's good because, you know, we did talk about him quite a bit last week, so I don't want to go into it too much. But I the thing I loved about his little hero interview was he said, "Look, I was really bad for a long time." And it says, and I'm not back to where I was. I don't have the dominating, you know, he basically said what we said last week, what Michael Westphal and I said last week. He doesn't have the dominant pitch anymore. His splitter is no longer, you know, or as Jose Lopez used to say, his, you know, counter to that, Jose Lopez, who said his two-seamer is the best splitter in Japan. Well, it's no longer the best splitter in Japan. So he's yeah, changed his game, and he says I'm getting back little by little to, but I'm just not able to summon that dominance that I once had, but I'm trying. So cut me some slack.
I mean, he looks very well. He looks very good this year. So
yeah,
that's definitely a welcome change, because he was like really awful for the past, what, 2 or 3 years.
Two and a half years. I mean, really,
you wouldn't trust him.
Yeah. I think to
pitch.
I think really he's the reason that Alex Ramirez got fired, was because he kept, you know, he stuck with him longer than he probably should have. And
yeah,
and so you had a closer who was misfiring most of the time, and you had a team that was losing a lot of late leads and lost a lot of close games, because the BayStars had a record that should have finished them, you know, second in the league, but they ended up finishing fourth. So, okay. So we had that. So I did like that, and congratulations to him. And other news we had, in addition to Masahiro Tanaka winning his second straight game, Shintaro Fujinami. Wow. He's looking like, you know, he's having this little window the last 4 weeks where he looks like the guy we remember from 2013.
Yep.
So good luck for him and Tanaka, and wow, I'm excited about things going on. Now, we're not going to have any high heat questions. We're going to save those next week for John and I. But anyone who has a question, hit us up on Twitter at JBW Podcast with the hashtag High Heat. Send questions via email to yakyujohn@gmail.com. That's yakyujohn@gmail.com. Go to the Facebook page, leave us some criticisms, comments, praise, donations. Okay, just kidding about the donations, or questions. Look for us on Google Podcasts and iTunes. Claudio, it has been an absolute delight having you on the show. We need to do this more often. And
yeah, definitely a pleasure as all mine.
Okay, and see you all at the ballpark. And thanks for listening.
Follow the hosts on Twitter at JBW Podcast and at JBallAllen. Submit your questions with hashtag High Heat and listen for an answer in an upcoming episode.